For part two with Hank Wesselman, let's put it the way Larry Dossey does. Hank is an expert guide who fully realizes that he's playing with scientific and spiritual dynamite. Stay tuned. I'm Robin with Tributaries.
Shamans have been journeying into the dreaming of nature, into the lower world, for millennia, for tens of millennia, in order to connect with power. Because some of these animal spirits are willing to come into relationship with us to provide us with things like power and protection and support and teaching if they're so inclined. Why would they do this? Well, the fact is that humans camped out for the first 2 million years of their evolutionary history. You know, we didn't begin to live in settled communities like villages and towns until about 10, 11,000 years ago. Before that, we were very much part of nature. And many of these nature spirits have not forgotten their ancient connections with us. Now, above this world are the upper worlds, the spiritual dimensions of the higher spheres, if I could put it that way. This is where you find the dreaming of the gods and the goddesses and the higher organizing intelligences, some of whom are in service to humanity. And those are what people usually call the angelic forces. They're dedicated to being of service to us. But, you know, they don't get involved with our lives and mess with us unless we invite them to. You know, this is very important because there is a spiritual protocol, if I've got this right. You have to invite them to come into your life. But once you do, life can be an extraordinarily enhanced adventure, you know, which my life has been. You know, I've reported in on this in my most recent book, which is called The Re-Enchantment, The Shamanic Path to a Life of Wonder, in which, you know, I've drawn on a lot of my field notes, so to speak, and experiences, and created this book to encourage others to step onto this path as well. So, you know, the fact that shamans exist in some form everywhere, and the fact that they all perceive the other world in very much the same way, I find this very compelling because it suggests that these visionary journeys are not products of our creative imagination. We're tapping into something which clearly is separate from the self and has its own agenda. And it also suggests that humans, as many anthropologists have suggested, express a kind of psychic unity in the sense that we're all, as human beings, set up very much the same way, psychologically and psychically, which means that all of us, to some extent, have the degree to tap into these non-ordinary realities.
Hank, I find it very refreshing that, especially since you hold yourself as a scientist, you're not betting that science will define the great mystery. Does it come down to apples and oranges for you? How do you see that?
And talking about the great mystery is an interesting perception, and it's a very accurate one. I came to think of my connections with the other world as my connections with, quote, the mysterious, close quote, because the mystery is just always out there. It's just always in front of us, and we can reach for it, but we can never quite grasp it. We can never quite understand it. It's what Lao Tzu said when he was trying to describe the Tao. He said, the Tao cannot be named. Words can be used, but none of them are ultimate. It's its nature to remain mysterious, but I think its job is to draw us forward to that which we're destined to become. And when you step onto the path of the mystery, when you engage with the mystery, everything is different then. Nothing is the same again.
How hand in hand do you see the evolution of religion and the evolution of culture leading into the new mysteries you write about in The Re-Enchantment?
Well, this is a long story. I used to teach anthropology at the university and college level, and I had a whole class dedicated to magic, witchcraft, and religion, which was a big seller. And I always had about a two-week session where I'd talk about the evolution of religion with slides. You know, our organized religious traditions, they're only about 5,000 years old, if that. And before that, we had this mystical tradition, which was dominated by shamans. The shaman was the one who was able to use their own mind and their own body to create a bridge between the personal world of form and the transpersonal world of spirit. And when that bridge was formed, it allowed the healing gifts, for example, from the spirit world to flow across that bridge of body and mind into our world, where it was able to manifest things. Now, in terms of religion, spiritual unfolding, if I could put it that way, spiritual unfolding, the unfolding of our soul as it grows, progresses through four stages. The first stage is belief. And this is where organized religion kicks in. You know, you can have religious beliefs, you can have magical beliefs, you can have mystical beliefs, you can have rational beliefs, you can have scientific beliefs. And beliefs are very sustaining in the short term. But when you look at your life, for example, your belief in Jesus or your belief in God or belief in angels, you know, not much changes in your life over 20 or 30 years. In other words, there's no growth. So we eventually reach a point where our beliefs no longer compel us. And that's when the second stage kicks in. The second stage is faith. And faith is a great sustainer, again, in the short term. But, you know, many people stay with their faith and their beliefs for all of their lives because they're comfortable with that. Faith can take us in two directions. Into one direction, it spirals us back down the hill into belief. And that's what fundamentalism is. That's what the whole born-again movement is all about. And it's a trap on the spiritual path of immense proportions because, in my experience, it will not bring you into connection with what you're seeking. But when faith is doing its job, it takes us in the other direction. It takes us up the hill into the third stage of spiritual unfolding, which is direct experience. And when you've had the direct experience of spirit, when you've had that awesome jolt of connection with these transpersonal forces, it takes you immediately to the fourth and final stage, which is personal transformation. And personal transformation is about change. And I remember I had a chapter on this in the book, The Reenchantment. But let me backtrack a little bit with you as well. You know, this book, Spirit Walker, my first book back in 1996, brought me into connection with a Hawaiian elder named Hale Makua. Now, when I was living in Hawaii in the 1980s, you know, I became aware of the fact that there were kahunas like Hale Makua. But, you know, they didn't talk on the phone. These were elders. You didn't just call them up and say, gee, I'd like to have lunch with you, because they didn't talk on the phone. But in 1996, which was a year after Spirit Walker was published, I was in Hawaii with my family for Christmas. I was teaching in California at that time in two colleges, 3 days a week. And I was invited to speak at an institute up in Waimea on the Big Island. And on that day, I drove up there with Jill, and I guess I planned to give a rather academic talk on the transformational community. That's you and me and all of our friends, and it's all the members of our club. And I was just about to begin my talk, and the door opened, and in walked this big Hawaiian man. Now, I'm 6 feet tall, and he was at least half a head taller than me. He had a great big white beard down his chest and a big white ponytail down his back, flashy aloha shirt, shorts, and a carved walking stick, which was just magnificent. He was introduced to me by my host as Hale Makua. Now, Makua was a formidable person in the sense that he was a direct descendant of King Kamehameha on his mother's side and of High Chief Keuwa on his father's side. In Polynesia, genealogy is everything. It determines you. It determines your status. It determines your mana. And so I was really in awe of the fact that he'd come to hear what I had to say. And he came with, I think, six or seven other Hawaiian men, all of whom had beards and ponytails, and they had their wives with them. This was a good sign. It means I wasn't going to get turned into a pillar of salt, at least not that day. Now, I felt uneasy because in Spirit Walker, I had stumbled into the Kohona tradition of Hawaii, and I had written about it. And you know and I know that indigenous people feel uneasy when outsiders get involved with their spiritual traditions, especially writing about them. So before I gave my talk, I thought it would be a good thing to invoke my spiritual protection. So I made a short prayer quietly to myself. And Makua, as he was called, he didn't miss that. I gave a talk which lasted for about an hour, and then at the end of that talk, I had this feeling like something was pulling on my soul, and I had the sense that he'd come to talk to me, to say something to me. Well, there were about 50 people in the room, so I asked him, I said, Elder Makua, I don't know what the protocol is in addressing you, but I have the feeling that you've come here to say something to me. Would it be correct for me to invite you to speak? Now, he did something. I watched him dissociate, and he was gone for about 45 seconds, and then he was back. What I didn't know was that he was checking in with his ancestors to see how much he could say to me. So he looked at me with a smile, and he said, a friend of mine sent me your book, Spirit Walker, and I read it. And then I read it again just to make sure I got it right. Silence in the room. I mean, this was like high noon in Polynesia. Okay, you could have heard a pin drop. He said, I went down to the beach and I took your book and I put it down in the sand and I called in the ancestors and we had a talk about you. Silence. He said, the ancestors asked me what your name is and I told them your name is Wesselman, Hank Wesselman. And he laughed, and he said something to me, which I'm going to share from a place of sharing, not from a place of ego. He looked at me and said, ancestors told me I wasn't pronouncing your name right. They said, your name is Vesselman, that you're a vessel like the canoe. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm slowly going into shock because I'd been preparing myself to be condemned. Well, I didn't know it, but Makua was psychic, and he was reading me. So he looked at me and said, don't worry, we Hawaiians don't write. We talk, and we share what we find in our hearts with each other. But in your tradition, it's correct to write. And so the ancestors have told me to say to you that we Hawaiians need to support you. Keep spreading the word. You're making my job easy. Mm. Well, the emotional release in the world and the room was quite extraordinary. I mean, some people were crying. Because it's so rare when an indigenous elder endorses an outsider. And Makua wasn't just any kohona. He was the big kohona. Okay. Well, this was the beginning of a most unusual friendship. And over the next 8 years of his life, Makua and I and my wife connected, reconnected, and reconnected over each year, maybe four or five times. And we had the most extraordinary conversations, mystical, philosophical conversations. And when he passed in 2004, none of us were ready for him to go. And about a year later, it was like a credit card swipe went through my mind. And suddenly Makua's spirit was inside my mind, and we were having conversations like we had in life. And although I wasn't allowed to take notes when we were having our meetings here on this side of the mirror, I had my laptop in front of me. So I began to write this stuff up. And eventually it was published as the book, The Bowl of Light, which has been very, very well received by the international community. The Hawaiians haven't responded to it very much because I'm an outsider, and it's tricky because they don't like outsiders.
Yes, as you said, they don't write. They talk.
Yeah, that's it. So, you know, when that first meeting with Makua happened, it happened at a place up in Waimea, a Frank Lloyd Wright house. And Makua looked at me that day very seriously and said, "We should have a meeting before you leave the island." Well, listen, when the big kahuna says you're going to have a meeting, we met at the volcano, the Kilauea volcano in Volcano National Park at about the 4,000-foot level. This is the volcano goddess Pele's traditional home. And we spent the entire day talking together, the three of us. And at the end of the afternoon, Makua reached in the back of his truck and he gave us a gift. It was wrapped traditionally in the Hawaiian way in tea leaves. And when we opened it, we found this beautiful wooden bowl, a simple Hawaiian wooden bowl. And Makua looked at us and said, "This is your bowl of light." He said, "When each one of us comes into this world at the beginning of life, our Aumakua, with a capital A, I might add, our Aumakua, our higher self, our spiritual soul, which does not die, it divides itself and it sends in a bowl of its light, like a seed, which takes up residence within a new embodiment for a new lifetime. That's our light, and that light nourishes us and sustains us throughout life." He said, "But whenever we step into the negative polarity, whenever we take something that doesn't belong to us, whenever we injure somebody with our words or thoughts or our actions, whenever we achieve success at the expense of somebody else's failure, it's like you put a stone in your bowl and some of your light goes out." He said, "Life is long, and slowly but surely our bowl of light fills up with stones until there's virtually no light coming out of it anymore." And as an aside, he looked at me very seriously and he said, "You know, the major problem in the world today is that the world is being run by men and women whose bowls of light are filled with stones. These are dark people, and there's no light in them anymore." Then he looked serious again, and he took the bowl from me, and he said, "Hopefully, we learn what we're doing before it's too late." And he said, "You know what you do then?" And of course, Jill and I are hanging on every word, and I said, "What?" And he turned the bowl over, and he said, "We dump it out." Laughed, big boisterous laughed, and he said, "In Hawaiian, we call that kala, K-A-L-A, cleansing." He said, "But once we do that, we then walk our path in a different way. It's at this point that we become spiritual warriors."
Yes.
He's looking at it very seriously, and he said, "You know, I'm talking with you because you're spiritual warriors. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be talking together. And I suppose the same thing extends, Robin, to you and to your listeners. They're all listening because we're all in the same club together."
Yes.
Now, he said, "The path that we walk on as spiritual warriors is a very narrow path, and it's constrained by three sacred directives. Number one, we must love all that we see with humility." But when he said that, I thought to myself, wow, easy one first. And of course, being psychic, he was listening in, and he laughed and said, "Don't worry, I worked on that one for 7 years.
You're right.
Number two, we must live all that we feel with reverence. And this reverence is not a social convention, okay? In talking with Makua over the years, he talked about the nature that each one of us has a foundation. And he said the foundation stone of Western mind is domination, is dominion. Our God gave us dominion over. He said the foundation stone for indigenous mind is respect. That's a very different approach to life. And I'll have to say that in all of my years in the indigenous world, primarily in Africa, I was always offered respect by everyone. That doesn't happen very often here in the States anymore. Mm. Yeah. Well, okay, love all that we see with humility, live all that we feel with reverence. And the third, know all that we possess with discipline. Self-discipline is absolutely essential if you're going to watch the spiritual path. And this is where so many of the spiritual teachers and gurus have stumbled. And we don't have to mention them. We all know who they are, and we all know their stories. Yeah. Self-discipline is very, very important. So those three directives, you know, extend to everybody, and it was the core of his teachings.
I love that you said live all that you feel, as Makua said to you, is the foundation stone of the indigenous mind. You talk about the new mysteries in your book, how the hand-in-hand journey of cultures and religions and life and consciousness is changing, and moving beyond thinking that God or Creator would either respond to or even receive worship is a big part, I think, in taking this responsible move into our own within spirit.
Well, you know, I took a big risk in the re-enchantment, and one of the things I've written about is this transformational community we're talking about, and how there is a new perception of God which has come into being. In fact, the God in heaven who listens to our prayers, works in mysterious ways, and sends occasional messengers to earth, us, who usually get treated very badly, is not some fatherly mono-God who has off days and good days and lives off-planet. You know, that's a myth. The God in heaven who listens to us is our own personal God self, our higher self, our spirit soul, which does not die. And then there is another higher level of God as well, to whom we have access, and this is our spirit guide. The spirit guide is not the leopard man. The leopard man is a helping spirit. Spirit guides are actually the caretakers and teachers of our higher self. They're godlike beings who've been through everything that we've been through. These are the two levels of deity. And one of the things that I teach when I teach with the Shift Network, for example, I'm going to have a 7-month online program coming up, which begins in February. I'm teaching a 7-weeker right now with them. It's really fun. You know, one of the things we do is we begin with nature mysticism, which is where the shaman works primarily. But eventually it propels us upwards into authentic deity mysticism. And this is quite different from organized religion, because shamanists don't worship spirits. They're in relationship with them. It's about relationship. It's a reciprocal rotary energy, which in my opinion, by the way, is feminine, in which nobody's keeping tabs on who owes who what. But it's a back and forth. And when you're talking to yourself in the shower, for example, or in the car, who are you talking to? You're having a conversation with somebody. We call it talking to ourselves. Yes, but which self? You know, this is the higher self who's listening in and communicating back with you. This is a very different perception of God or deity, but one which is ultimately user-friendly, because our God self wants the best for us. It's the one who loves us unconditionally. It always has, and it always will. Yeah, very different from the punitive Old Testament God. There are over 1,200 cases of violence, condoned violence, by this Yahweh guy, telling his followers to cut down the sacred groves of the pagans, kill and smite unbelievers, etc., etc. That's not a godlike being. That's somebody else. No. I've written about that guy in the re-enchantment as well. It's probably going to get me in a lot of trouble.
Oh, I hardly doubt it.
I might just say, part of what allowed me to become who and what I am and allow all this spiritual stuff into my life was the fact that I've always been intensely curious. I've been curious about everything. And sometimes my curiosity has gotten me into a lot of trouble. But, you know, on the whole, I've had a very enriched life, almost a mythic life. And I've tried to convey that in the books that I've written, because I think that life is available to all of us. This is a nice thing, don't you think?
I agree. And I am a lover of nature. And yet I don't hold that peace where we need to have nature in order to have a full spirituality going. You quote the Zen master Mathiasen in your book, and I'll read the quote. "Lying back against these ancient rocks of Africa, I am content. The great stillness in these landscapes that once made me restless seeps into me day by day, and with it the unreasonable feeling that I have found what I was searching for without ever having discovered what it was." And yes, nature does that. Yes, you experience that after weeks on end in your fossil finding days in Africa. And I think we can feel that if we are caught up in New York City. And I just want to state, I guess, that we don't have to have anything holding us back.
There are no limits. There are no limits. And I must say that whenever I go back to New York City, when I teach at Omega, for example, in New York State, I always go to Central Park and I visit with my trees, the trees that I played with when I was a little boy. And interesting thing is, a couple of days before I go to New York, they become aware of me and they come into my dreaming. Mm-hmm. And so there's this compulsion to go to Central Park and just kind of sit with my trees, which I do, and I also make offerings to them. My signature offering is a crow bead. This is a colorful glass bead. Indians like to use them in their beadwork. The crow bead is a fairly good-sized bead, and so I will make my prayer and blow it through the hole in the bead and then wedge the bead into a crack in the bark. The trees seem to like it.
Well, that's a lovely relationship to continue.
Well, listen, you know, for those of you, your listeners who are interested, there are all sorts of stories on my website, which is sharedwisdom.com with a D, sharedwisdom.com. And if you go to stories, you're going to find a couple dozen stories of wonderfully mystical happenings, as well as my teaching schedule for next year, as well as my books.
Great. Well, thank you for sharing so much with us today and so much of your experience in life that I'm sure is most appreciated by so many.
Well, thanks for your time and thanks for interviewing me. You know, it's always a pleasure to reach out and connect with others who are out there on the trail. You know, it reinforces the understanding that we're onto something.
And it's yes, we are.
Something quite considerable, yeah.
Yes, we are onto something, and I'm very glad that Hank Wesselman, author of The Reenchantment, was able to share some of what he's onto. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, or sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasting is at iTunes as Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.